We're doing Unit 7, which discusses the Bhagavatam verses from 8 to 10 of the second canto, and also the first four chapters of Canto 3. We have spent a lot of time on the chapters of Canto 2. It does contain the seed verses of the Bhagavatam, which need special attention. And there is significant discussion on the creation, especially Saga, or the primary creation. Which is quite a difficult subject matter to comprehend. At the end of the 10th chapter of the second canto, the sages request the Sonika Rishi begins to inquire about Mahatma Vidura and his discussions with Maitreya Muni. Now, this was mentioned earlier in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the first canto, chapter 13, in the first couple of verses. there was a little discussion there about Vidura. So, the sages, having heard lengthy discussions on the how the Lord manifests in material creation, they're getting very eager to hear some of the actual transcendental activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as no doubt some of our students here. And that's what happens in the third canto, of course. The sages of Naimisharanya, many of them are liberated souls, and of course it's not improper for them to want to push Sudha Goswami in that direction. At the same time, those who are not so well educated in transcendental affairs, it's actually good for them to hear the topics of material creation quite at length, until they come to a better position where when hearing the transcendental activities of the Lord there, some of their material conceptions of the Lord have been eradicated. So we have to look at ourselves also as a group, as a class, how ready we are to move into the third canto and look at some of the transcendental activities of the Lord. Up until the end of the 10th chapter, the second canto, there has been discussions on the material creation, and it gets taken up again in the third canto after a little while. In other words, there is some discussion on the pastimes of the Lord, the nature of Krishna, but again, because it's early in the Bhagavatam, the speakers quickly go back to the topics of creation, just to, again, having heard the human-like pastimes of Lord Sri Krishna, I just want to make sure that those who are hearing firmly understand that they sound very human-like, but you must understand that he is possessing immense potencies. And therefore the topic again comes back to how the Lord utilizes different potencies with regard to creation, maintenance and destruction of the universe. So I thought, just before we go into the third canto, perhaps we could just have a little revision. Now last week we went over a summary of creation, taking the topics, you know, in a somewhat chronological way, and discussing the topics that come up in the second canto and the topics that also come up in the third canto. So we sort of, we did jump ahead a little bit, but just keeping the theme of creation. Who heard that lecture, that talk? Huh? Last week? Yep, so you heard. Anyone not hear that? Okay. Everyone else heard that? Yep. Now the reason we went over that is that many of the topics concerning creation, you get a little chunk here, a little chunk there, and it's very easy, especially for us, to forget where we left off and where the next part takes up again. And so you know, that discussion is particularly important. You can always refer back to that talk, because it does run a, you know, consistent theme of creation, so you can understand where the different parts of the Bhagavad Gita, especially second and third cantos, referring to creation, where they actually fit in. So having heard that, I just want to perhaps I might ask the students just a little revision, especially on chapters 9 and 10. Who can give a summary of, let's say, especially chapter 10, will make it a bit easier. Who can give some sort of a description on the process of creation that has been given in this chapter? So what is being described, and just, you know, where it sort of fits in and where it leads to in the process of creation. Who's read this chapter? Everyone's chapter 10? Yep. Anyone not read? Everyone's read it? Okay, so having read it, okay, I need to see how we've assimilated. So I'll give you a minute to have a quick look at your notes. While you're doing that, I'm just going to talk in the background. Now, you know, of course, the topics of creation get somewhat technical, and no, as devotees, according to the level of service, devotional service that we do, according to our faith in the Acharyas and the Supreme Lord, we will manifest within our heart understanding of these different technical subjects. It can't be understood just by being a bookworm. and you know, therefore, even hearing these different subjects, as we have over a few weeks, different students will understand, you know, in different capacities. Now, the main thing, of course, is that each of the students is satisfied that they at least coming to a level of understanding whereby they have faith in the descriptions given in Srimad Bhagavatam. We certainly wouldn't want students at this stage of Bhakti Vaibhava to be doubting the Srimad Bhagavatam. But at least, if, you know, they may not understand all the technicalities, but at least their understanding should be sufficient to have firm faith in Lord Sri Krishna, the Acharyas, and Srimad Bhagavatam. Other students may understand these topics to the point where they're becoming familiar enough with these topics that they can very effectively preach Krishna consciousness to all levels of people. And other students that may not necessarily be on that level now, hopefully they will come to that level gradually as their advancement in as a devotee, you know, progresses. So we're not expecting everyone to be erudite scholars at this point, but certainly if there are there should be you know, a firm understanding of the basics of what's been presented, and there should be, for most devotees, an ability to draw significant points that they can understand for preaching purposes. I had a little conversation with Chris last time at the end of class, and you know, we were discussing, it came up that you know, ultimately it's very important that as we're going through our daily lives, when we come across different people in different circumstances, if we're able to present some part of this analysis of creation satisfactorily, so that someone who may be presenting the theory of Darwin's evolution, or you know, the Big Bang, or you know, so many different theories like that, that a devotee with just even the beginning understanding of these sections should be able to get that person to reasonably accept that, oh yes, actually the Srimad Bhagavatam may be offering a more scientific understanding that they should look into. At least if we can get people to understand that, you know, that's very important. So, you know, many people have children going to school. You know, the children are going to come home from school and ask questions of the parents. you know, people have work colleagues. You know, people are, you know, in all sorts of different situations. And of course, sometimes, you know, doubts may even come up within our own hearts. But for all these different reasons, we actually need to be able to take, you know, significant portions of this section and quite effectively present it in a preaching situation. And also, you know, as a manifestation of compassion, that if someone does inquire from us, and we're the only devotee contact that someone is going to have, and they make an inquiry and we can't say something significant to help that person take steps towards Krishna consciousness, that's you know, that would be a very sad situation. And in many cases, you know, we are going to be that devotee who is the only person, the only devotee that someone will contact and ask them, you know, so why don't you believe in evolution, you know? Why do you accept God, you know? why don't you, you know, believe in the, you know, Big Bang theory, you know? It's just a question, but the answer to that can help a person who's been, you know, traveling in the material world for millions and millions and millions of lifetimes, all of a sudden, if they get a satisfactory answer, it can actually turn them and, you know, release them from the cycle of birth and death. And we've studied that in many different sections of the Srimad Bhagavatam, that if someone asks the right questions, that can allow that person to be practically liberated, put on the path of liberation immediately. If they ask the right questions, so it's very significant. And we've seen how, you know, the Bhagavatam discusses that, you know, generally people in the human form of life, people don't ask these questions. So it's extremely significant, you know, if someone does ask a question. So, you know, some of the things we're going to look at today is how some of these, you know, things that we've learnt can be presented in a, you know, different points that may have very good preaching application. We'll look at that, and as we go, we'll also see, therefore, how the devotees are actually assimilating the knowledge that we've gained so far through hearing, and also, you know, through our other different types of services. So, but anyone like to begin? You don't have to present the whole process of creation. Would anyone like to give a couple of sentences just to kick us off? Yep. Yes. Okay, let's take it up to that point. A good start. Not very game, the first one. First one off the rank. So now there, the preacher was describing that it begins from Mahavishnu, of course, yep. And Mahavishnu does generate the universes which enter the material energy. And then he does enter the universes as in Gavadaksha Vishnu, and later Brahma comes. Yes, let's go a step back, yeah? Yes, yes, so, yep.
So the, from there, yes, the rest is going on. He is generating universes from his force of the body.
Yep, so the, as far as we take a step back, Mahavishnu is first glancing at the material energy while he's laying on the causal ocean. And agitates the pradhan with his time energy, and also impregnates the jivas, the living entities, within the pradhan, and gradually the material energy being agitated, the three modes of material nature which are there in a state of equilibrium begin to manifest the primal ingredients of creation within the Mahatattva, and the universes are actually, as the Lord breathes, the universes expand into that Mahatattva. So then Gavadaksha Vishnu, taking the living entities and the ingredients of the Mahatattva, then he enters within the universe. And causes the universe to expand into the universal egg. And so I'll just leave it there. So,
okay, just one more to complete that. Vishnu also, he is lying in an ocean there.
So Gavadaksha Vishnu is lying within the Gavadaka
ocean,
yes, at the bottom of the universe, which is half filled with the Gavadaka water, yes. Alright, some anyone like to add to that now? Step back. Yes, so there must be a cause, and so far we've established that the cause is Mahavishnu, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but it's definitely not a material cause. Yeah?
Just is it okay to say that as Mahavishnu breathes, it comes, or it comes from the pores on the skin? Is it the same? It doesn't matter?
It's the same. Yeah, yeah, because that he is breathing through the pore holes of his skin, of his body. Mm. So what do we call that when, if we take the three different time periods, so we've discussed Mahavishnu, Gavadaksha Vishnu, and Brahma. There are three different time periods there. What? How do we describe those? What are the names for those? Yeah, Mahakalpa, Vikalpa, Kalpa. Which one's which? Kalpa is the day of Brahma. Yeah. Vikalpa, yeah, is the lifetime of Brahma. That is the breathing period of Mahavishnu, the Mahakalpa. So, so the saga creation, or the creation of the primary elements, happens within the Mahakalpa. and then at the beginning of Brahma's lifetime, we begin the Vikalpa or Vishaga, Brahma's secondary creations, and then in each day of Brahma there is a partial creation.
What happens? What you said?
Yes.
In Brahma's,
at the beginning of Brahma's lifetime, which is the Vikalpa. That's when Lord Brahma generates all the bodies for all the living entities. And, you know, just expands the universe, which is already being created somewhat by Mahavishnu and Kapilaksha Vishnu. So that's Vishaka.
Person's lifetime is not given, it's just a fraction of
Brahma's day. Person's lifetime. Yes.
So we're talking about the body being generated.
At the beginning of Brahma's lifetime. Mm-hmm. The beginning of Brahma's first day, the beginning of his lifetime anyway, he does the secondary creation, generating the living entity, the bodies for all living entities. So the creations of Brahma is Vishaka, beginning from the beginning of Brahma's lifetime. And the creations of Mahavishnu, and even up to Garbhadaksha Vishnu is Shaka, primary creation.
My confusion was that the living entity must be dying and taking birth many times.
Mm-hmm.
In Brahma's one day.
Yes.
In Brahma's one day itself, the living entity is going through so many life cycles of
yes.
death, of birth and death. So, I mean, you're saying that a living entity is a secondary creation in the Maha, in the Vikalpa of Brahma.
Yes, up until the beginning of Brahma's life, the living entities don't have bodies.
That's true.
And from that point they begin to take on succession of bodies. And that's called Vishaka.
I thought that is part of the Kalpa of Brahma. My understanding
was yes.
The Kalpa, not the of Brahma.
Yes, but it is Brahma's creations are there in each day of Brahma.
Yes.
So Brahma has 30 days in a month, 12 months in a year, and 100 years in his life. In each of those days of Brahma, the Vishaka is going on. In other words, the creations of Brahma go on in each day of Brahma. Because at the end of each day of Brahma, there is actually annihilation, and then there is creation. And that creation in each day of Brahma is, you know, the same, similar, and that's Vishaka. But all the primary elements that Lord Brahma is using have already been created in the Mahakalpa of Mahavishnu and with Garbhadaksha Vishnu as well. So, you know, the Vikalpa comprises all of Brahma's kalpas. And the breathing period of Mahavishnu generates many, many Brahmas. Alright, so... Alright, so we've discussed the primary elements have been generated by Mahavishnu through his time element and through the jivas being impregnated within the material energy. Gradually the Mahatattva manifests. Garbhadaksha Vishnu enters within each universe along with the ingredients of the Mahatattva and the living entities and time and their karma, and in this way what happens. Now Preeti has said that from there Lord Brahma is generated, and you gave a little summary after. What I wanted to know is, where does our 10th chapter of the second canto fit in to this description? Yep. Yes, they are. in the 10th canto, we do discuss particularly saga, primary creation. In what way is that discussed? How is that? Who would give a summary? Chiradakshaya Vishnu, yes.
Yeah. So he is.
Garbhadakshaya Vishnu is the super soul of the universe, and Chiradakshaya Vishnu is the super soul of the individual.
And
Chiradakshaya Vishnu is lying again in the big ocean. Yes.
So, the two oceans, how are they separated?
They're
just in different places, in the same universe.
Yes, one is at the bottom and one is at the top.
Sure. And so, Chiradakshaya Vishnu.
But the ocean of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu fills half of the universe. Where, you know, Chiradakshaya Vishnu is situated in the. You know, in the region of the pole star, it's you know, the waters of the Kshira, the milky ocean, is not considered to be as expansive as the waters of the Garbhadaka ocean. It covers half the universe. Okay, so we're still want to get an idea of how the descriptions of the 10th canto, just a little summary of what happens, what was described with regard to creation as to, you know, where we're up to so far in our summary. Yep.
The description of creation in
definitely, yes, definitely the description of creation gives us, expands our understanding of the immense potencies, even just with regard to material creation, of Krishna. Therefore, when we hear his pastimes, we won't take him as an ordinary person. But still, my question is, what are those descriptions of creation in this tenth? That's what I'm asking. from the 10th chapter of the second canto. That was described, the 14 universes is actually described in earlier chapters, in the 6th chapter, I think it was, and even in the, way back in the beginning of the second canto. But in that, those descriptions there are not so much discussing creation, as to, some of them are discussing how to meditate upon the universal form of the Lord. Whereas as we get on into this chapter, it actually describes how creation happens. And so we want to look at, you know, what is that description of creation, and where it fits in with the... Yes, it is mentioning how the so you've got one set of ingredients. Well, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Of course, were manifested, were described in previous chapters, being manifested. Here, there's an that's within the. You know, we've discussed previously how the Mahatattva was created and how those primary elements were generated. You see, the Lord then took those primary elements of creation within the Mahatattva, and he, taking those, he entered within the universe as Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, along with the jivas, separating the jivas into each universe, plus the time energy, and the conditional nature of the living entities, and their destiny, their karma. Then what happened?
Do you think that every aspect of whatever quality we have is basically produced by the Lord, and then we get like the Lord wants to walk, so he never connects only then he was also have.
Yes.
Because everything comes from the Lord. Everything, you don't have anything independent of the Lord. So whether it's taste, whether it's hearing, whether it's limb, everything is first manifested
from
the Lord.
That's right, yes.
And that's the reflection coming to us.
That's right. So the the Virata Rupa, when Garbhadakshaya Vishnu enters within the universe, he then manifests the Virata Rupa. So, of course, that should be the next principal statement. What happens when Garbhadakshaya Vishnu enters the universe? He manifests the Virata Rupa form. now, that Sukadeva Goswami has described that in the beginning of the 10th canto, first of all, he describes there are 10 topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and in order to understand the ashraya, or the shelter of all the topics, the other 9 topics are discussed throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam, and he lists what they are. And in this way, by understanding all the various topics, the principal topics, we can then understand something of the supreme shelter of all of them. So Krishna is the shelter of everything. So to understand Krishna, we need to know, well, what is he the shelter of? So therefore, it described that he is the shelter of material creation, and its primary creation, secondary creation, you know, maintenance and destruction, and the liberation of living entities, he is the shelter of everything. Everything that happens within material creation, he is the shelter of all those things. He is also the shelter of all the energies, including the spiritual energy. So, in order to understand Krishna as the shelter of everything, we have to know, well, what are those things he's the shelter of? So this helps us to understand Krishna and also helps us to understand his, that he is the absolute truth, that he actually comprises everything, and that there is nothing above him. He is the ultimate shelter. There's no shelter beyond him. The material energy is not the shelter. The impersonal Brahman is not the shelter. Krishna is the shelter of everything. Yep. So it helps us to understand Krishna. Then, in order to further help us to understand that the Krishna, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth, is completely independent. So he's the shelter of everything, but he acts independently from everything. There was a little description given how the Purusha avatars manifest, they create, maintain, and ultimately annihilate the material creation, and therefore, if a person creates something, maintains it, and annihilates it, that means that that person is independent from it, and therefore not part of the creation. He is not part of the maintenance, and he is not part of its destruction, because he is affecting all those things separately. So this interdependence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his expansions as the Purusha avatars was shown to show his interdependence, and in that way it also shows that the jivas, or the living entities, are completely dependent upon him. So he's independent, he's affecting the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the material universe, where the jivas are within in a conditioned way, and therefore they are completely dependent upon him. Later in towards the end of this chapter, it also shows that he is above material creation, and he is also above the Brahman, or the spiritual energy upon which the material creation is resting, in that he has not only is he maintaining, creating, and destroying everything, but actually he's doing it in such a way that he's not doing it at all, that by his energies and his expansions, all of that is going on, and actually he's not doing anything. He's not performing any action at all with, in relationship to all those things. It's described, the Vedic scriptures describe, they relegate that action to the Lord to show that it is not a material cause that's causing creation, maintenance, and annihilation. So they relegate it to the Lord, who's transcendental. But then, ultimately, we go a step further. Yes, it's relegated to the Lord. There's no material cause doing those things. And yet the Lord is so independent that he doesn't have to perform any action at all in order to facilitate that, being completely independent from everything and completely transcendental. In this way, the this 10th canto is showing in several different ways the nature of the Ashraya, or the Absolute Truth. The description of creation in this chapter is taking that particular mood of showing the independence of the Supreme Absolute Truth. You'll find that whenever different topics of creation come up, that the different speakers are in effect proving a particular point about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we're not just learning about creation for the sake of understanding creation, as the scientists try to, they just want to understand. We learn about creation because in this particular chapter it's actually showing how, everything is dependent upon the Lord, and at the same time how the Lord is completely independent. So, you know, yes, yep, that's right. And but herein lies a preaching opportunity, you know, because that's a very significant point. You know, that's the point to sort of pick up more so than all the details of creation. You know, to understand that preaching point. So therefore, as soon as someone presents any theory, no matter what it is, in which case they're not presenting that everything is dependent upon the transcendental personality of Godhead, we immediately know that they're talking nonsense. Right? It doesn't matter whether they're a scientist, doesn't matter whether they're Einstein, it doesn't matter whether they're, you know, this, that or the other, we immediately know, we've immediately detected that they're talking nonsense. Right? So immediately we have the preaching upper hand. And then it's our, you know, our opportunity, of course, is that, okay, what do I know, you know, from this chapter that I can somehow present that's relevant to what they're saying, which can show them that, no, everything must be dependent upon the absolute truth, which, you know, must be independent from creation. Right? You can't, the creation, the way it's set up, it must depend upon some person ultimately who is independent from creation. Now that's the logical, that's a very logical statement. And when we've given different examples, you know, we can take a watch. And, you know, we look at a watch and we, you know, you can very easily prove that the watch must be, it is dependent upon an independent creator who logically is a person, an intelligent person with controlling abilities. The material creation is no different. So it's applying the same principle. So herein, you know, lies the preaching opportunity that and the, you know, and the vision of the preacher, of course, not so much that we want to defeat people or make them look foolish, but there's an opportunity to help someone to understand something properly, not to remain in, you know, waste their entire life, you know, based upon different illusions like that. So it's an opportunity to help people in preaching. So let us look at
what,
you know,
what really struck me was to the extent we are really controlled, that even the movement of an eyelid is controlled by demigod.
That's, yes,
to the extent that we are already like puppets, nothing more than puppets.
Exactly, yes. So that's a good point. As we go through, then these very you know, powerful statements have immense preaching, you know, application, or, you know, an application for helping people to you know, understand things properly. So, you know, we're not necessarily fixated on, you know, we must know everything about creation. It's not possible. Even Lord Brahma, you know, can't come to that point. What about, you know, what to speak of us? It's a very, very difficult subject. But what we should be careful of is that we say, oh, you know, I don't quite understand this, I'll wait till other chapters, you know, which I do understand, and therefore miss the opportunity of gathering these gems of, you know, wonderful preaching statements, which can be applied by practically any devotee, you know, with just a fundamental understanding of, you know, the statements here in Krishna consciousness. One doesn't necessarily have to be a scholar on creation to pick up these preaching points and apply them very successfully. That's the point. So let us have a look at some of those, you know, different points that come up in this chapter. I know some have brought their third cantos, quite a few people. That's okay. I'm going to read from the second. I didn't bring mine. I've got the second canto here, thanks to Bolu. We're going to read some verses, and we're going to just look at some particular points of significance.
Chapter
10, yeah. Second canto. And now, also, it should be mentioned at this point that many of the descriptions so far, you know, up to the second canto of creation, deal with creation at the very beginning of Brahma's life. As we get into the third canto, actually the topics of creation kick off from the Padma Kalpa. And you see that at the very end of this chapter that Sukadeva Goswami, Sukadeva Goswami describes that he's going to then discuss some activities that took place in the Padma Kalpa. Now, the Padma Kalpa describes, it's called the Padma Kalpa because in that Kalpa, the universal form took the form of a lotus flower, and our acharyas suggest that you know, the universal form doesn't necessarily always take the form of a lotus flower, but in the Padma Kalpa it does. We are now in the Brahma lives for 100 years. And we're in the first day of the 51st year of Brahma's life. 50 years have passed. This is called the Svaita. There are 30 kalpas, and there are 30 days in each month. And the first one is always called Svaita. So, you know, the very first is also called, you know, it could be called the Svaita Kalpa, because it's the first, but it can be called the Brahma Kalpa, the very beginning of creation, because Brahma was actually born, the very beginning of creation, Kalpataksha Vishnu. the Padma, yep. Yes, yeah, we're in the second half of his life. So 50 years have gone. So again, you know, that means if we're in the first day, this is also the Svaita Kalpa, because the first day is always called the Svaita. But in this particular Kalpa, Lord Varaha appeared. So we see that, you know, there are Leela avatars, and generally they all appear within one day of Brahma, but apparently not all of them, you know, appear, and some kalpas, some particular kalpas are distinguished when there is something particularly, you know, unique about it. So this is also called the Svaita Varaha Kalpa. Yeah, Svaita Varaha. now, The many of the discussions of creation are referring to the Padmakalpa. The Padmakalpa is some consider this the Padmakalpa, and some consider the last day of Brahma's previous 50 year was the Padmakalpa. But we won't split hairs, but just for your information. So from the third canto, many of the descriptions of creation, which means the generation from the generation of the lotus flower, from that point on, are actually taking place in the Padmakalpa, and therefore you'll understand that it's different. There is a slight difference, and it's not at the very beginning of Brahma's life on the very first day of his life. This is, and it's a creation which is therefore at the end of Brahma's night. So, you know, there are some slight differences like that. They just need to be kept in mind. Alright. Now, in the 10th verse, we see that it describes after separating the different universes, the gigantic universal form of Lord Mahavishnu, of the Lord Mahavishnu in brackets, which came out of the causal ocean, the place of appearance for the first Purusha avatar, entered into each of the separate universes, desiring to lie in the created transcendental water, Karabadaka. So keep in mind that here we are showing how Lord Krishna, expanding as his Mahavishnu incarnation, is demonstrating how one, the Lord is the cause of creation, maintenance and annihilation, and also how he is completely independent from those things. So these points are being shown in this description. Ultimately, that points to the fact that the jiva is completely dependent upon the Lord, and therefore it's hinting at the importance of bhakti yoga. That one must surrender to the Lord, yeah?
Just trying to understand the step before that, because the part of the Saivishma is reclining upon Anand and then the Mahatattva comes. So how that and this is how it goes later?
Yep. Okay. So from this point, I'll read it again. After separating the different universes, the gigantic universal form of the Lord, Mahavishnu, which came out of the causal ocean, the place of appearance of the first Purusha avatar, entered into each of the separate universes, desiring to lie on the created transcendental water. And you just want a little refresher on where this fits in to the overall process of creation. Okay. Now. We've heard in the fifth chapter that, and in previous chapters, that the Lord has glanced at the material energies, agitated the material energies by his time element, set the modes of material nature into motion, creating material manifestations. The jivas have also been impregnated into that prakriti, the Mahatattva has manifest, producing the actual primary, manifesting the primary elements of material creation. Gavadakshaya Vishnu enters then, actually Mahavishnu, the universe is emanating from the pores of his skin. The universe is by the energy of the Supreme Lord, those universes, the Lord himself energizes those material, primary material elements to cover the universe, the seed-like forms of the universe, and the Lord also enters within the universe as Gavadakshaya Vishnu, from his own body generates the Gavadaka waters which fill, and then the universe, he lays down on that universal water, and he lays down on that water, and he has within himself, so this is happening in each of the universe, each Gavadakshaya Vishnu has within himself the jivas that will later come into that universe, and he also is the Mahatattva, the primary elements are there with the Lord, and he utilizes them in a way which we'll actually find out in this chapter, how he utilizes the different energies. These seed-like universes remained on the causal ocean, having been generated from Mahavishnu for 1,000 years, you know, 1,000 celestial years. And then Gavadakshaya Vishnu, he entered within the universe, and he also remained there for over 1,000 years. And that's, you know, the point we're up to here. Yes, yeah, they're golden seeds.
And so it has the material elements in that, how?
They're covered by the Mahatattva. They're covered by the Mahatattva, and then, but only because the Lord himself, I'll read you the description. We read in the fifth chapter of the second canto that the forms the forms of the body cannot take place as long as these created parts, all the elements of the Mahatattva, namely the element, sense and mind and modes of nature, are not assembled. So in the next verse, verse 33, thus when all these became assembled by the force of the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this universe certainly came into being by accepting both the primary and secondary causes of creation. So, as Prabhupada mentions in the third canto, in the 26th chapter, that at that time when the causes were unmixed, Gavadakshaya Vishnu entered within each universe. Accompanying him were all the seven primary elements, the five material elements, the total energy, Mahatattva, and the false ego. This entrance involves his entering even into the atoms of the material world. So he also entered as Kshiradakshaya Vishnu. we read in that chapter how actually the various predominating deities of those elements prayed to the Lord to assemble those ingredients because they could not do it themselves. Oh, actually, that was described in the third canto, sorry, in the fifth chapter of the third canto.
Isn't that the job of Mahavishnu,
that mixing the ingredients together? Well, I'll answer that. It is the job of Mahavishnu, and therefore he expands as Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. It's actually described in the 26th chapter that from the seven principles, indicating, you know, the primary principles of the Mahatattva, roused into activity and united by the presence of the Lord, an unintelligent egg arose from which appeared the celebrated cosmic being. So it describes also in the sixth chapter of the third canto that when the 23 principal elements were set in action by the will of the Supreme, the gigantic universal form of the Visvarupa body of the Lord came into existence. So, in essence, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu expands from Mahavishnu, enters within the seed-like form of the universe, which has appeared from Mahavishnu, and then expands as Shiradakshaya Vishnu. Shiradakshaya Vishnu entering within the each and every element allows the universe to the elements to be compacted and expand, and also Garbhadakshaya Vishnu creates the space within the universe, lays down upon that, and with the Mahatattva that is also and the living entities, he then begins to manifest the universal form. So, in answer to your question, you know, it appears to be saying from these verses of the third canto that, you know, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu enters within, expands as Shiradakshaya Vishnu, who enters within each and every atom, and that allows the universe literally to, you know, be covered by the elements of the Mahatattva, and also then to for the Lord to expand the universal form within the universe. So Shiradakshaya Vishnu literally within each atom you know, is present to allow that universal shell to properly develop, the universal egg. So we have the universal elements that have been manifested by Mahavishnu, and they pray to the presiding deities of those elements. They pray to Mahavishnu that, you know, we can't, you know, do anything independently. We can't all join together and create anything. We don't have that power. And they pray to Mahavishnu and then Mahavishnu expanded as Gavalakshaya Vishnu, entered within the universe, taking with him all the primary ingredients, and also entering within each and every atom, within the heart of every living entity, as Shiradakshaya Vishnu, and then the universal egg is expanding. Which is, and that's the point where we come up to here in this verse, 10th verse of the 10th chapter, in the second canto. So therefore the Lord is called Narayan, because the water of the Gavadaka Ocean was generated from Nara. Nara is a person, and because the waters emanated from him, he is known as Narayan. Yes, there are different meanings, but in this sense and at this stage of discussing the creation, we would take this particular aspect of its meaning. In verse 12 it describes that one should definitely know that all material ingredients, activities, time and the modes and the living entities who are meant to enjoy them all exist by his mercy only, and as soon as he does not care for them, everything becomes non-existent. So, just describing a little bit about how powerful is this Supreme Lord dwelling within the universe as the generator of the universal form. Everything depends upon him. And of course, this is the important point we're following. Everything depends upon the Lord. Everything depends upon he. Everything is completely dependent upon him, and he is completely independent. In verse 13, describes the Lord while lying on his bed of mystic slumber, generated the seminal symbol, golden in hue, through external energy out of his desire to manifest varieties of living entities from himself alone. Catch that? So we know that the Lord has been sleeping on the Gavadaka Ocean for 1,000 years. So in essence, rising from his mystic slumber after a long and peaceful sleep, alone in the universe without any distractions, he created the universe from his own energy, and of course we will see that Yasrajat Tridha in three features. He created, and we will see that those three features are the Adi Devam, the Adi Atma, and the Adi Bhuta. So, just going back a couple of steps, we described that after Sukadevi Goswami described the 10 topics of Srimad Bhagavatam, to show the nature of the Asraya, or the cause of the Absolute Truth. He then showed the nature, how the Absolute Truth is independent from the other 9 topics, by describing the Adi Bhuta, Adi Deva, and the Adi Atma, Adi Atmi. The Adi Bhuta is the material body, the gross and subtle senses. The Adideva is the controlling demigods of those, and the Adiatma is the controlled or the living entity who experiences through those gross, through the material body, the gross and subtle senses. So it's describing here that now in those verses, I think it's 8 and 9 of this 10th chapter, Sukadeva Goswami described that if we look at the Adibhuta, the Adideva, the Adiatma, we see that an independent person must have set up those three, because each one by themselves is useless. A demigod, you know, who's there to control the material bodies, without material bodies to control, has no value. Material bodies that are controlled by the demigods have no value if there's, you know, no demigods. And the living entity, if that's not is there to experience through the material bodies and be controlled by the demigods, what is the value of the other two? So each one has no value unless all three are there. And for all three to be there in an interdependent relationship, there must be someone independent who has set them up. Right? So here it's describing that the Lord, at this point here, actually created the universe with these three features. And therefore, you know, in essence, we're beginning to understand this important preaching point that the Lord is completely independent from the universe, which is an interdependent system, right? Like a watch. The watch is all interdependent parts. The universe is all interdependent parts in three categories. So he's beginning to, he described it previously, now he's describing it in detail, how it actually unfolded. So just looking at the commentary by Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core on this, he does say that you know, talking about Gavadakshaya Vishnu, that having created the elements such as the Mahatattva by his energy, he created by these elements the universe with its layers. It's also describing there that, in essence, Gavadakshaya Vishnu who creates the layers of the universe. And of course, we understand even to do that, he would expand as Kshiradakshaya Vishnu within each and every atom as well. So, in this commentary by Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core, he's describing that the Lord Gavadakshaya Vishnu manifests the universe with its layers and then actually enters within. Lays down on the Gavadaka ocean for 1,000 years, rises from his bed and manifests the totality of the universe in three forms: Adideva, Adiatma, and Adibhuta. Now,
when we are saying 1,000 years, it is 1,000 years of hours or 1,000 years of
a thousand celestial years. Now, we spoke also in terms, at this point we can refresh ourselves, we had three terms: Maha Samasti, Samasti, and Vyasti. Maha Samasti was in essence the total energy, total material energy that was manifested, total material energy manifested, actually the total energy manifested by Mahavishnu. Gavaraksha Vishnu actually enters within the universe with that total energy, and manifests the universe in three different features. That total energy is Samasti, and as it becomes manifest in three different features, it is known as Vyasti. So that means that the Gavaraksha Vishnu enters within, and within him he has the total energy. That total energy that is within Gavaraksha Vishnu will later manifest as the lotus stem and the lotus flower, which comprises the 14 planetary systems. It will also manifest the Hiranyagarbha, or the subtle universal form, which in essence is the totality of the jivas within that universe. And it will also manifest the four-headed Brahma sitting on top of the lotus flower. So that you know, total energy of the Lord will manifest the entire universe, and that entire universe will have three different principles of the control, the controller, and the material bodies. So, you know, here we're seeing that in this description we understand that everything is dependent upon the Lord, the Adiatmic, the Adibhautik, and the Adidaivik. So in every way we look at it, the Lord is independent from these, and everything is dependent upon him. It's the same point that is being shown, you know, in this description. Yeah, this same event which is happening in one universe is happening in all the universes, yeah.
There the demigods are being created in there.
Yep, we're going to discuss that now, how the various principal demigods. Okay. Now verses 14 to 16 describes, just hear for me how the potency of his lordships divides one into three. Called the controlled living entities, the controlling living entities, the controlled entities, the material bodies, from the sky situated within the transcendental body of the manifesting Mahavishnu, sense energy, mental force, and bodily strength are all generated, as well as the sum total of the fountainhead of all of the total living force. So, is describing here the total energy. From the total energy, you know, will manifest the shaktis, which manifest the bodies, the sense energy and the mental, you know, inner senses of the mind. Yeah. We'll come up to that. All right. That's a fair bit down the track. It describes in verse 16 that as the followers of a king follow their lord, similarly when the total energy is in motion, all other living entities move, and when the total energy stops endeavoring, all living entities stop their sensual activity. So you have here there is the total energy is within the Lord, and later it will manifest in these three different features, but in essence it still remains the total energy as far as the Lord is concerned. And therefore when the total energy moves, you know, all living entities are manifested by that total energy. They move, the total energy stops, they stop like this. So both are going on like that. So we may see things from our perspective as a living entity, but we also have to take it into consideration that from the total energy, the Lord is moving the total energy, you know, combined. Here the example of a king is given. So for instance, if the king says, we are now at war with such and such a country, the whole energy of the entire nation will move with that king or queen. All men, women and children, their energies will be moved by that energy of that leader, as we have seen in different books. Right. Now, Prabhupada points out there, he says that he says from the sky, or we can call it ether, situated within the transcendental body of the manifesting Mahavishnu. Now the manifesting Mahavishnu at this stage, of course, we are talking about Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, who is beginning to manifest the universal form. So in essence, within the space, within the universal form, these things are beginning to manifest. Prabhupada, in his purport, and also, you know, in the various commentaries, we see that it is describing the Lord is manifesting the particular energies, which underlie all the mental activity, sensual activity, and the bodily strength of all living entities, which will soon be generated. It is described here as sutra, and sutra we've described before is a part of the Mahatattva. When the Mahatattva is particularly agitated by the mode of passion for creation, it is known as Sutra Tattva. So in essence, it's, you know, he's talking about the, you know, Mahatattva with the living entities. So again, you know, verses like this are showing the greatness, let me stay close to the mic, verses like this are showing the greatness of the universal form. Now, just like we describe the greatness of a king or a ruler, you know, by their will, the whole nation moves. Just like we see the pyramids of Egypt, you know, and they described how many nations had to go to build the monuments to these great kings. You know, their whole energies for lifetimes, many lifetimes, to fulfill. You know, so how great those, you know, Egyptian pharaohs were. The pyramids and the various monuments, a testament to their greatness. So this is a statement like this, that, you know, universal form is so great that, you know, when they move, all living entities within the universe, without the exception of any, they move. You know, like this. So it's just a statement like that. Prabhupada gives a very nice example in that purport about just as an electric lamp has no electric lamp has independent effulgence. Every electrical instrument, so here's a nice way to put this in a preaching context. Each and every electrical instrument depends fully on the total powerhouse. So now, when people say that they're, you know, I'm just acting independently, why are you always talking about God and things like that? And why are you even, you know, then you can explain, well, actually, you're not independent. You'd have to be living in a false paradise to think that you're independent. Because, you know, you are in a chain of dependency that goes all the way back. It's just that you can't see the links. So you can give an example like this, that we're talking about an electric lamp. Every electrical instrument depends fully on the total powerhouse. The total powerhouse depends on the reservoir of water for generating electricity. Water depends on the clouds. The clouds depend on the sun. The sun depends on creation. And the creation depends upon the movement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yeah. So, you know, it's very, you can trace it back quite easily. You know, for a devotee, if someone says, oh, you know, I'm just acting independently, you know, I don't need God or religion like that, a devotee will think, well, that's, you know, a very foolish statement. You just, you're so dependent and you can't see any of it. It means you're living in complete ignorance. But it's not difficult to show them, you know, that dependency. You know, as a preacher, there's a very... see, now, even if you can't understand creation, if you can just prove there's one point, they've got to surrender to you. Huh? And usually that's what Prabhupada would do. Is that, you know, he would just get them on one point. If you can thoroughly defeat someone on one point, then what happens is that they decide, well, then I must listen to him. You know, next time I meet, or what have you. Quite often, the big one point that people come up to a devotee with is their only point, you know. That's a fact. There's not many philosophers. Usually people have one thing. One point, you know, why, oh, I don't believe in God. There's one thing. And if you can just easily dismantle that, they've got nothing. There's very few will have a backup philosophical point. I just stress it. Yes, so you just have to be able to discuss that one point. Alright, so whatever point they bring up, you just have to discuss that one point and very, very solidly discuss it. So, keeping on the topic of creation, verse 17, the living force being agitated by the Virata Purusha generated hunger and thirst, and when he desired to drink and eat, the mouth opened. So now we actually begin the description of the universal form of the Lord manifesting within the total energy of the Lord within Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. Now, Prabhupada makes a very significant statement in this purport, verse 17. He says, the process by which all living beings in the womb of the mother develop their sense organs and sense perceptions appears to follow the same principles in the case of the Virata Purusha, the sum total of all living entities. This Virata Rupa is being manifested within the energy of the Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. The Garbhadakshaya Vishnu is laying within the waters, although he's arisen from his mystic sleep. In a sense, he actually has risen. He's probably sitting up. It's in the third canto we hear that the universal form, having been amalgamated within the form of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, actually manifests as the lotus flower. In the third canto, we'll see that in the 26th chapter describes that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Virata Purusha, he situated himself in that golden egg which was lying on the water and divided into many departments. In other words, he differentiated the apertures of his body. Now, Prabhupada is giving this analogy just like a child within the womb. Where does a child develop the apertures of its body? Within the womb. See? So, from Prabhupada's statements here, from statements later in the third canto, it appears that, within the womb, or, within Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, this universal form is manifesting the various apertures of the universal body. We haven't yet come to the point where the universal form, the lotus, actually sprouts from the navel of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. In unveiling his lotus feet, Burijan, taking this section, just quotes that same sentence. From his energies and by his will, the Virata Purusha gradually develops, just as a child develops in the womb. So, As it says, the living force being agitated by the Virata Purush generated hunger and thirst, and when he desired to drink and eat, the mouth opened. Now, we're going to see in this description, goes right up to about verse 29 or 30, that what happens, that one after another we'll see that the palate, the ears, the eyes, the nostrils, legs, hands, skin, genital, anus, navel, abdomen, mind, intestines, life, breath, and then some of the parts of those elements, you know, the blood, fat, marrow and bone are generated. Each of these bodily parts, which is the adibhautik person in the Virata Purush, for each of those, the appropriate controlling deity, the adidevic person, is generated. Now, it's not always stated. In fact, in these descriptions, sometimes part of the adibhautik is not mentioned, the adidevic or what have you, but we have to understand that it's giving the principles, and therefore in each case the adibhautik, the bodily parts, the adidevic, the demigod, and the adiatmic, you know, the living entity who is within the material body and controlled by the demigods, they're being generated, although they're not always stated. So what's that?
Now this is happening, the Adhideva, the controlling deity.
Yes.
Inside the temple of the stage.
Yes, within the worm.
Oh, yeah.
Within the abdomen.
So it means that he's given a certain body because he's a demigod, right? So he's given a certain body to control the...
Yes. some of the... there are, I think in all Vishwanath Chakravartitikora mentions there are 18 principal elements that are generated within the universal form. And, so the demigods, three features are you know, the, you know, because the jiva is there. Certain jivas are, as the mouth of the Virata root manifests, and the palates, the various demigods that control taste enter within that aperture of the universal form, that particular living entity. Who will later be given birth. So, you know, this is happening on a more subtle level, that later, you know, as the universe is manifested within the lotus stem of Gavadakshaya Vishnu, Brahma is the first created being with a fully manifested body, and later all the demigods are born from Brahma. But at this point here, premature to their birth, within the womb, so to speak, things are happening for some of the primary demigods. And therefore sometimes we hear that, you know, certain demigods, you know, like in the Purusha Shukta, they pray to the Lord along with Brahma, because Brahma is also generated. You see that, you know, I think verse 30 describes mind, intelligence, false ego, you know, all those things are also generated within the heart of this Virata Purusha, which means Lord Brahma also manifests at this stage of the Virata Purusha. The description is given later on. that he will be the firstborn. So, you know, generally we think of an embryo as having, you know, one child, or maybe twins. Here the embryo is all living beings, but within that embryonic state of Garbhadaksha Vishnu, Brahma and other demigods, who are principal demigods for the different parts of the universal body, are being manifested in the embryonic state. And, you know, therefore we see that, you know, when, you know, before, even before creation, there are prayers, you know, within the Purusha Shukta by the demigods. And they utilize the parts of the Virapa Purusha to bring about creation. When the universal form actually manifests from the lotus flower, yes, the universe is actually there, but Lord Brahma does finish it off. He does the finishing work. So at this state, all the principles of, you know, adi-bhautik, adi-daivik, adi-atmik are being manifested within the Virata Purush. And therefore, you know, if we go through these verses 17 to 31, we'll very easily see how, you know, all three aspects are completely dependent upon the Lord, who is completely independent. Verse 18, we won't go through them all, but verse 18, from the mouth the palate became manifest, and thereupon the tongue was also generated, and after this all the different tastes came into existence so that the tongue can relish them. And Prabhupada says there in his purport that this gradual process of evolution suggests the explanation of the controlling deities Adideva, because Varuna is a controlling deity for the all relishable juices. This suggests therefore that Varuna is also generated along with the development of the tongue. So Prabhupada is confirming, although it's not stated, you know, in the actual translation, the understanding is that the demigods are also generated at this state. Prabhupada says that in his purport, and the other acharyas agree. And, you know, further, they take this understanding from other statements which are stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which we're not aware of yet, which we come across. Basically, the gross palate and the sense object are the adibhuta aspect. The subtle sense organ is the adiatma, and Varuna, the presiding deity, is the adideva aspect. So, the sense objects are also generated. So, Prabhupada does mention that at the end of his purport, he says, the four principles mentioned in this verse serve to explain the three main principles. So keep in mind that the sense object is also generated. That's the fourth principle, and that's just, so those, all the four items are describing the three principles: adideva, adibhautik, adiatma. Alright, jumping way ahead to verse 30. We see that when there was a desire to think about the activities of his own energy, then the heart, the seat of the mind, the moon, determination, and all desire became manifest. Now, As mentioned by Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core, he's pointing out that if we go into the sixth chapter of the third canto, there's a little bit of elaboration on this particular verse. You know, in verses 23 and 26, it actually elaborates by saying that it's also understood that in the location of the heart, the senses known as citta, false ego, and intelligence also reside with the mind. And the devatas, you know, the presiding deities of Vasudev, Rudra, and Brahma also appeared. So we'll see that in the third canto. It's not particularly stated here, but we should understand that therefore Brahma is also generated within the Virata Purusha at this stage. You know, in this embryonic stage of the Virata Rupa. Okay. Alright, so that gives us a you know, some understanding, at least with understanding. Actually, this section of creation is important, because if you understand this section of creation, you'll be able to understand easily the third canto. If you miss this, you're actually going to struggle with the third canto. So this is, you know, it's a crucial understanding. Apart from that, then there is the various points which are very significant for preaching, you know, understanding, which we're going to look at some of those here. The verses from about 33 on describe how the Supreme Lord is independent from this material manifestation and the Brahman which it rests upon. Itad Bhagavato Rupam, in verse 33. Thus, by all this, the external feature of the personality of Godhead is covered by gross forms. Right. Prabhupada mentions in his purport that these coverings are created by him to cover the eyes of the conditioned souls who want to lord it over material nature. Going back to... was it the 7th chapter, 6th chapter, where it described how the conditioned soul becomes originally conditioned by the material energy, covered, appears to have fallen, you know, into the from material existence. What chapter is that? Is it chapter 5? The first three verses of...
Chapter 9.
Was it chapter 9? Yes, chapter 9. That's right, yes. It described there how the living entity is covered by the material energy. And we've just got a really good description how the living entity is covered up to this point of creation. Shows how the Lord has just covered the living entity. Right? But understanding, very significant point, that it's the living entity who's actually covered, not the Lord. You know, so those those points in chapter 9, you know, they were made there in chapter 9, and again Prabhupada is referring us to those same points at the beginning of chapter 9. Yes, yes, that's right. In, that's right. It does mention in chapter 5. Yes. So the Lord is covering the living entities, although it appears that the Lord is covered. The covering of the gigantic material feature is accepted by such men with a poor fund of knowledge. You know, so for instance, very neophyte on the path of being a transcendentalist meditate upon the universal form, that is the form of the Lord, whereas, you know, as it describes later, the Vaishnavas do not accept that this is a form of the Lord, because it's not manifested by his spiritual, internal spiritual potency, and therefore it does not exist. It only exists within the realms of the material energy. It does not exist in the spiritual realm where there is no influence of the material energy. Verse 34 describes, therefore beyond this gross manifestation is a transcendental manifestation finer than the finest form. It has no beginning, no intermediate stage, no end. Therefore it is beyond the limits of expression or mental speculation and is distinct from the material conception. So, in essence, avyaktam nirvisheshanam. The absolute truth is beyond the expression and speculation of the material conception, Prabhupada says in his purport. So, these two aspects of the Lord, the universal form, where the Lord is everything material, and the Lord's impersonal feature, his the Lord is nothing material, as Virajan Prabhu puts it in his book, are the aspects which the pantheist and the monist aspire. People believe that I had a discussion even with a devotee the other day. Everything is God in one sense. That, you know, even the activities of non-devotees are God. Everything is God. Basically, not different from God. So why discriminate? Why preach to them? And all the various demigods are also non-different from God. That's pantheism, right? That everything is, you know, many, many gods, because everything ultimately is... all the varieties within creation are in fact non-different from God. So Shiva is God, Ganesh is God, Durga is God, Kali is God, Vishnu is God. And ultimately, you know, they all rest upon the, you know, they may say that they all rest upon the impersonal Brahman, and therefore all paths lead to one. So there are many different philosophies like that stem from the fact that people cannot distinguish that the Lord is beyond the universal form, and that the Lord is also transcendental to the Brahman feature upon which the universal manifests. So many, many different philosophies, and therefore in verse 35, neither upe epi na grananti, neither of the above forms of the Lord, as just described unto you from the material angle of vision, is accepted by the pure devotees of the Lord who know him well. Now, here is a particularly significant preaching application, because every philosophy that you will hear apart from Vaishnavism will fall into this monistic or pantheistic conception, which means that people are seeing the Lord from the materialistic point of view, that everything is the material form of the Lord, God is everything material, or that God is nothing material. So, you know, from those, all the different philosophies and religions of the world are based upon those two conceptions, and yet the devotees reject those two conceptions as not actually pointing to the actual real feature of the personality of Godhead. It's like saying that you know, in one sense, you know, it's like the example that Prabhupada gives of the elephant in the dark room. So, you know, basically they're looking at the elephant from pitch black. So someone is grabbing the leg and they think, oh, that is the elephant. Someone is grabbing the trunk, oh, that is the elephant. And he's grabbing the ear. I mean, elephants are pretty big, you know, so you can't grab everything like that. So you know, someone may think that you know, in one sense, individually none of those things are the elephant. The elephant is something more than the ear that it's grabbed. You know, if someone grabs the ear, the elephant is something more than the ear. So you can say that, you know, someone will say, well, the elephant is the ear, and someone will say the elephant is not the ear. So in essence, the elephant is something more than it is this or it's not that. There's some, you know, that's it's like that. There's something more that they can't quite grasp. It's that sort of example, because they're seeing it from darkness. Like that. And then in verse 36, Bhagavan Brahma Rupa Drik Nama Rupa Kriya Dete. His transcendental name, quality, pastimes, entourage, and transcendental variegatedness. All right, so he manifests all those transcendental aspects of his personality. So, you know, we know when the Lord appears within the universe, he actually appears to be affected by the same covering and moving with the material universe just as every other living entity. But actually it's pointing out that you know, he has his transcendent name, form, qualities, pastimes, you know, everything like that, which have nothing to do. So looking at that statement, we take it from the beginning that some supreme person has existed before material creation, as described by, you know, to Lord Brahma in the ninth chapter, and he created the material universe. And then we've just had a description how he does that. He creates it, he maintains it, and he destroys it. So that person is existing, you know, separately and independently, as we've described, that an independent person must set up this interdependent situation in material creation. So that's been proved by Sukadeva Goswami. So there is a person, and therefore it's describing in this verse, and he had, so he must have, you know, a name, quality, pastimes, so like this, entourage, transcendental variegatedness. So he is completely independent, and he's existing like that. Therefore, when we see him, you know, appear within the universe, we understand that, you know, he's completely independent, not part of the universe, but that he can appear within it to maintain it, to, you know, help reclaim the living entities. So, for us who study the Srimad Bhagavatam, we keep both conceptions in our mind, which is very important, because in the third canto we're about to hear some of his human activities when he comes into this world. But we're keeping two things in our mind. One is that we know that the independent Supreme Lord, you know, exists before creation, he's completely independent from it, sets up the material creation like that. Then when he enters within it, that same person cannot be considered to be a product of the material energy, considering the fact that we just discussed that he, you know, set the whole thing up as an independent person. So we've got two things in our head. The non-devotees have one thing. Oh, I see someone in the material world with me, so he's the same as me. So we you know, we keep those two things thoughts that, and of course Prabhupada gives the example of the you know, when you know, maybe a government official comes into the prison, or any of the, you know, even the prison guards and what have you, you know, the prisoners think, well, you're in here with me, so we're, you know, all part of the same prison system. You know, I'm a prisoner, you're also, you know, part of the prison system. It's sort of quite foolish. The what makes it very, very hard for, you know, for people to understand that point, of course, is, you know, in the scriptures, when the Supreme Lord comes, he shows us how we should behave in the material world so that we can get out of it. But when people see him behaving like that, they think, well, you know, why is he acting in this material way before, you know, it's like he is also subjected to the same rules and regulations. Therefore, we see in the Ramayana, you know, Lord Ram, he prayed to Lord Shiva, and Arjuna, you know, prayed to Durga, you know, to get their blessings to perform, you know, particular battles and what have you. So people who read the monists and the pantheists, they read the Ramayana and they think, well, you know, it says in the Ramayana that, you know, that Ram worships Shiva. So that proves that he's subordinate to Shiva, who basically controls the material world with Durga. In the same way, if say you know, the Prime Minister of Australia decides to visit one of the prisons, while in that prison she will obey certain rules. She will seek permission from the prison, you know, warden, that I would like to come and visit at such and such a time. With your approval, you know, I will come. And when she then, so she's sought his, she may even offer him a gift and say some nice words. And when she comes, she will follow certain rules and regulations of the jail in order that, you know, everything is maintained, and also sometimes to set an example for the prisoners. But does that mean that she has now become subordinate to the prison warden and therefore on the same platform as the prisoners? So two things must be kept in mind. What is her position? Well, she's the independent, you know, Prime Minister of Australia, and then she comes into the prison. Two things keep in mind. Not the one thing that I just see her in the prison, everything else forgotten. Like that. In verse 27 to well, let me see, is it 37 to 40? Basically, know from me that all living entities are created by the Supreme Lord according to their past deeds. In happiness and distress, or in mixed happiness and distress. So there's a very distinct difference. The Supreme Lord is creating all others and maintaining all others. But everyone else is created by the Lord and being maintained and awarded their destinations by the Lord. So, again, Prabhupada makes some significant points in there. One, of course, is that the Lord is the father of all living entities. Right? That even though, you know, a child is born from the womb of the mother, we understand that the father has placed the seed. So therefore material nature is not the, you know, giving birth to the children, but the Supreme Lord is actually placing the living entities within material nature.
The
scorpion and the rice, that it's not the rice giving birth, but the scorpions have laid their eggs there, so appearances. And the other thing Prabhupada does mention in this purport about, you know, no one can be happy in prison life. And the intelligent person should not try to be promoted from third class prison life to first class prison life. Right. So basically by good association, one can change his habit by good or bad association. And the best association is the service of the devotees of the Lord. The verse In essence, that is describing creation. In verse 42, we see that he, the personality of Godhead, as the maintainer, who is also the maintainer of all living, of all the universe, he appears in different incarnations, of which we have the Manvantaras, some of the different, one of the six different types of incarnations of the Lord, and thus they reclaim all the conditioned souls among the human beings, non-humans and the demigods. So, of course, that's you know, we've seen how the Supreme Lord is completely independent, and even though he sometimes comes within the material world, we should keep in mind that it's proved that there must be an independent personality of Godhead who sets up the creation as an interdependent situation. Therefore, if that person comes into the material world, we should not think that he's one of us, and he would only be doing that by his causeless mercy, which is another very, you know, significant point. Now, who made the point before? Shweta. That if God is all good, why do bad things happen? So here, you know, this is the answer to that, that, you know, the Supreme Lord actually comes into the material world constantly in so many different, you know, more incarnations than there are, you know, waves in the river. Yeah. Presents so many different shastras and so many different representatives to help people to come to a point where they can actually live in this world without getting themselves into a situation of suffering. And even if they have got that, he comes into the world to help them get out of that situation. So, you know, when the Supreme Lord is doing that out of his causeless mercy, because there's no other reason than out of his great mercy, you know, how can one then say that somehow that he is responsible for others' suffering when he's constantly trying to help people to get out of that situation of suffering? It's like, you know, if someone's fallen into a well and you know, someone is up top saying, you know, I'll help you get out, and he throws down the rope, and you know, someone says, well, somehow or another it's your fault that I'm here. He says, no, I'm just trying to help you, you know. Stop arguing with me. So you know, there'd be no cause, you know, a drowning man in the ocean. Quite often when people are drowning, you know, someone swims out to get them. And my spiritual master, he had training as a lifeguard. You have to come up from behind them and you take them from, you know, the back, because if you come up in front of them, they'll actually attack you.
They'll pull you down.
And they'll take you down with them. And they think that you're trying to, you're making it worse for them. Mm-hmm. They keep, you know, get up, drowning. You know, it's like they'll actually fight you. Yeah. I said, so you actually have to come up behind them like that. So it's like that, that, you know, people claim, you know, why is God causing all this trouble, and they're fighting the very person who's trying to help them.
Well, they'll ask, grab you the way that drags you down with them.
Yes. So as Prabhupada points out, he comes back to his you know, the Lord's described as Param Bhavam. He has a transcendental nature, and that can never be understood by a materialistic conception. And he comes back to the frog in the well which, you know, we come up earlier in this canto, where we see that chapter 5, the frog and the well, that the frog is estimating, you know, another frog jumps into the well, it's from the Atlantic Ocean, and the frog is saying, well, is that your Atlantic Ocean well, you know, twice as big as my well? And he's trying to compare everything from his own standard. So try and understand the Lord from our own standard is the frog in the well philosophy. It can never be done, but out of the causeless mercy of the Lord, he will actually help us. So that, you know, at the end of the millennium, the Lord himself in the form of Rudra the destroyer will annihilate the complete creation. So we've creation, maintenance and annihilation are discussed here. In essence, the annihilation of the world also helps the living entity to become somewhat detached from material existence. Otherwise, they may, you know, decide to rot in illusion and suffering, you know, forever. But the very fact that the material existence is set up that they, you know, there is major annihilations, you know, helps them to become a little bit detached. Well, they certainly fear it, you know, just like people fear that when the sun will go out, you know. We read from the diary excerpts from Indrajumna Swami, saying that there are no atheists in the foxholes of war. In the foxholes of war, ultimately they all turn to God. You know, they may go there as atheists, but when they get into those foxholes, and gradually as the war, you know, surrounds them, they all quickly give up their atheism. Okay, any questions or comments?
That's why we question that.
Yes, it's Srimad Bhagavatam helps us to appreciate the mercy of the Lord and go back to the spiritual world. Now, Sukadeva Goswami describes verse 44 that the great transcendentalists thus describe the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For the pure devotees deserve to see more glorious things in transcendence beyond these features. Right, so the Lord is not only the creator and the destroyer of the material manifestations. Right, he's more than that. He has his feature of Ananda. Therefore, you know, we see in the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam also describes the five different stages of understanding the Lord. There's Anamaya, Pranamaya, Manamaya, Jnanamaya, Vijnanamaya and Anandamaya. I think in the 13th chapter, yeah. people don't know the Lord. You know, even one goes up to that point of understanding the Supreme Brahman, they still don't know the feature of the Lord as Anandamaya. So, you know, people don't know. So, you know, this here, Sukadeva Goswami is saying, yes, there's the, you know, impersonal feature of the Lord, there's the material, you know, covering, which is the covering of the living entities, actually. But you know, there's another whole feature to the law which the devotees, that's what they're really interested in, the Anandamaya stage of realization of the Lord. That's where you actually get that. That's the stage where you actually know the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As verse 45 says, there is no direct engineering by the Lord for the creation and destruction of the material world. What is described in the Vedas about his direct interference is simply to counteract the idea the material nature is the creator. So in essence, on his platform of Ananda Maya, enjoying, you know, spiritual pastimes with his associates in the spiritual world, he actually does no actions at all with regard to creating his maintenance and destruction of the material world. That's his real feature. And yet, by his inconceivable energies, everything is happening like that. Directly by, you know, by it, it is resting upon him, and at the same time, he doesn't have to do anything. So, it's that feature of the Lord that has nothing to do, no actions, related to the material energy that the devotees, you know, ultimately want to know. Yeah.
Is that one applicable
for
Purushottam? For Purushottam, the three
Vishnus?
That is, they don't have to do anything. They don't do
what they're saying. Well, in essence, Prabhupada answers that by saying Karana Dakshai Vishnu is a planetary expansion of Krishna. It is he who electrifies the matter to put it into motion. So, even there, it's describing that even in his form as Karana Dakshai Vishnu, the Lord doesn't actually literally directly move the elements of material creation. He sets it into motion, and he, you know, even just by his glance. So he really, he doesn't have to be hands on, you know, in the sense that people understand what God may be doing, you know, literally manipulating, you know, the material existence personally, directly. Just Prabhupada gives the example that, you know, the engine of a locomotive shunts one carriage, and then that carriage shunts the next, which shunts the next. So everything is going on, a little push, that's it. And even that push is just a glance. Yes, that is the glance of the Lord. So we've discussed the process of creation and annihilation in summary, and during the Brahmas one day, and as described in verse 40:26, it's also the regular principle of creation of the Mahatattva. So, taking from where we leave off here, of course, then one would reflect upon Lord Brahma's vision in the ninth chapter, where he actually perceived, you know, the personality of Godhead in the spiritual world, surrounded by his associates. You know, he actually saw also Krishna with Radharani and the gopis and, you know, the residents of Vrindavan, Krishna playing on his flute, so many different, you know, Saravi cows and like that. So, you know, Krishna did reveal to Lord Brahma that aspect of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, keeping in mind where we leave off here, that is that aspect that the devotees are interested in, and we've got a glimpse of that in the previous chapter, and then in the next chapter, in the third canto, we take up where it leaves off, and we start discussing a little bit about the activities of the transcendental personality of Godhead. And then after, you know, taking up that subject matter a little bit, just to make sure that the devotees are not, you know, going to fall back into the, you know, bad habit of seeing Krishna's human activities from a material perspective, it again takes up the topic of creation, like this. About the sixth chapter, I think. Well, we will discuss some of these aspects that we've discussed today will be taken up in the 5th, the 6th, the 8th, the 20th and the 26th chapters of the 3rd canto, plus more. So, be here. We'll also hear about actually how the lotus flower actually then comes from the abdomen of Kapadaksha Vishnu. Alright, so I think we've covered the second canto now quite well, so I won't be doing it again next week. We've spent a few weeks just to make sure that you've all got it. It's a very important section. Next week we'll definitely be doing the first two chapters of the third canto. Who started that? Who's good? Practically all of you, right? Nearly everyone. Okay.
Is that what you're asking? You started
the third canto. Yep, third canto. You have. No. All right. So. Wherever you're up to, you've got a couple of verses to go. Just make sure you read the whole thing. Makes it, then you have a lot more questions for me, and you get a better understanding. And if there's things that, you don't understand, then you get the opportunity to ask me those questions. Where if you haven't completed your reading of it properly, you won't even ask the questions. And then you may ask me later on when we're trying to move on to something else. All right, thank you. Hare Krishna.
Just a very big question.
Yes?
Who's powerful, Manu or demigods?
Who's more powerful? Manu or the demigods? Manu is under the control of some of the demigods. See, some of the demigods are considered adidaivic demigods, or they're particularly in charge of control of the universe, in which case Manu would be under them, whereas some of the demigods are not so much principally involved in the controlling of the material universe, but may be assisting other demigods in their universal, the maintenance of the heavenly planets to some degree.